I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
As I'm sure you know, Team Human is a labor of love supported by teammates like Ellie Hofteling, Liz, David Kaufman, Ewan Kenny, and Barbara Foner. You too can become a supporting member of Team Human by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support. You'll get stuff and love and access to our Discord channel and special live salon events and all sorts of cool things. So come join Team Human and find the others. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, where we face our greatest fears, share them with others, talk them out, and then break on through to the other side. Yeah, you're on the special 200th episode of Team Human, and we're taking no prisoners but setting y'all free. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, founder of the Media Education Lab and author of Mind Over Media, Propaganda Education for a Digital Age, my friend and mentor, Renee Hobbs.
I mean, if communication history has anything to say about it, things might get worse before they get better because we got to figure it out.
Renee's going to join me in the crucible of self-doubt and try to retrieve my hope for humanity. If you're game for that ride, then you're on Team Human. So just a week or two ago, I was talking about how I decided to turn off the WrestleMania passing for national news and focus on my local reality. I was hoping that helping neighbors, engaging in mutual aid, and working on local issues might just engender a kind of solidarity and maybe even eventually trickle up to the way we handle big issues. That maybe the way we interact down here on the ground in the real world would stand in such stark contrast to the sensationalist puppet show on Facebook and the cable news that we'd all, especially me, we'd all come to realize that the debates on TV, they're not an adequate representation of who we are, nor are they an appropriate venue in which to work out our collective problems. But so far anyway, I've been proven wrong. It's the same shit down here on the ground. The first local issue I jumped into was our town's decision on whether to opt out of New York State's legalization of cannabis lounges and dispensaries. It was really intense. Some parents are just horrified at the prospect of their kids becoming marijuana users, and in spite of ample evidence that marijuana legalization in dispensaries, they don't increase pot use. You know, if anything, and even according to the Journal of the American Medical Association, they tend to decrease adolescent pot use. I'm guessing because dispensaries just put black market dealers out of business, and then they make pot smoking look less cool to kids. Kind of like when everyone's parents went on Facebook and then kids didn't want to be honored anymore. I think it's sort of that effect. But it went nuts here after weeks of vitriolic rhetoric going back and forth on Facebook and at local board meetings. The town's board of trustees, just like the town, split exactly 50-50 on the issue. And then the mayor, she broke the tie with a compromise. She decided we could permit dispensaries, but then opt out of the consumption lounges. And it looked to me like she had taken that kind of wise, Solomonic approach that if everyone's a little unhappy, the chances are you've made the right judgment. And besides, our tiny town with too little parking and strict zoning rules, it's not getting a dispensary anytime soon. The whole thing was kind of symbolic, really more a way of deciding whether marijuana users are to be considered as socially acceptable as alcohol users who have, you know, two liquor stores in our own tiny little town. But as if they were taking their cue from the electoral politics on TV, instead of simply disagreeing with the outcome, the dispensary opponents, they refused to accept the legitimacy of the decision-making itself. They started insinuating that the whole process was corrupt. They accused the Board of Trustees of predetermining its decision and intentionally ignoring, you know, widespread public sentiment. You know, and that's the extra step that concerns me. When opponents, when they go meta on a problem to attack the legitimacy of the process or the sanctity of government itself, it's akin to like not accepting election results because you don't like who won. Then you say, oh, they cheated. And so they proceeded to launch this impromptu protest campaign of alternative candidates who've got no prior civic involvement. And it was characterized instead by the fake triggering news blasts about, you know, how the town was 10 to 1 against dispensaries. And there's no polls, nothing like that. You know, or that there were secret plans for a 200-unit low-income housing project. Look out. Or they said that the trustees intentionally retired during their terms so that their replacements could be corruptly hand-picked rather than elected. And none of this is true, but it all sounds really scary, right? Especially to kind of NIMBY people. And worse, it sets people against one another who should be working together on our mutual challenges. You know, we can't just trash government or break democracy because we agree with certain outcomes. That's taking our cue from the worst of what's going on out there, rather than leveraging our home field advantage as friends and neighbors to rise to the occasion of our disagreements with respect and goodwill. I mean, look at what the combative and histrionic tactics have done to Congress. Do we really want to follow that lead as people on the ground? No, we have to live with each other, and we simply must behave under a presumption of good faith. If we can't do it here in our daily lives, I don't know where we can.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So yeah, I am a little worked up here on the occasion of our 200th Team Human. I'm reconsidering my approach to public conversation. You know, I feel like maybe after all these years of trying to help people deconstruct the media, that maybe they're still so susceptible to narratives, to stories that, you know, maybe someone like Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster and wordsmith, was right when he told me, Rushkoff, do you want to win? And what he meant was, do you want to inform people and help people understand things? Or do you want them to do the right thing that you think they should be doing? And I always said the former, but now, you know, I'm wondering if people can handle the truth, if they want to handle the truth, or maybe 10, 15% of people should start worrying about what really the issues are, and the other 85% of people should just kind of be told and given a sweet story so that they behave nicely. I mean, that's a cynical view, right? That's the cynical view of a great progressive, Walter Lippmann, really the inventor of public relations, who he would have been considered a progressive, certainly by today's standards. But he said, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, sometimes you do have to just manufacture consent for what the right thing is, right? To get people to wear masks or do whatever it is that's going to be good for them, so they don't just go crazy and do wrong things, you know, and smart people or people who really care to read and learn about issues, you could tell them kind of what's really going on or the logic behind it, but spend more time giving people the story they need to behave in ways that are consonant with civilization. And, people like me, I mean, media theory types, programmer be program people, we've always disagreed with that. We've always said, no, no, give people the tools to understand, let them understand. And I want to retrieve that, right? I want to retrieve that faith. So I've called my great friend Renee Hobbs in to help me through this, to deliver me from this crucible of despair, and to help me reaffirm my commitment to media literacy education and the smarts of the so-called masses. So here she is, the author of a dozen books on media literacy, including a true masterwork on propaganda, Mind Over Media, Propaganda Education for a Digital Age, for which I wrote the introduction, and you should just go get this book right now. Here is Renee Hobbs. Hi, Renee.
Hi,
welcome
John.
To Team Human.
I'm so glad to be here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I'm calling you for help, maybe. I'm seeing above and below. I'm seeing evidence that people like Lippmann and Bernays may have been right, that the effort to actually educate the public on issues of importance so they can make smart decisions on their own behalf may be futile, and that people are just responding to the pictures in their heads. And maybe for the majority of folks out there, my job should not have been to deconstruct the media and help people see, which has just led to an almost QAnon-like level of research and activism, and just dedicate myself instead to telling really good stories that get people to just not be so bad to each other.
Wow.
So you're walking back on the whole Enlightenment project, are you?
I am. I'm wondering, what good did this do? I mean, maybe they were happier just being told stuff. I always said, here we are, I'm one of the Jews, and we don't spread the good news. We spread the bad news, that we're in charge here, that this is it, and we've got to make your own reality. There's no savior coming for you.
Well, I understand you, like the rest of us, are in the middle of an epistemological crisis.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
The nature of knowledge is changing, and what are you going to do about it? Right?
Right.
And Bernays and Lippmann were thinking about the relationship between information, news, and democracy at a time when there were gatekeepers up the yin-yang. They're not here anymore. Does the Enlightenment project still work without the gatekeepers? This is the question we want to worry about.
This is my question, and it keeps me up at night. And I know publicly and in my classes, I still say all the right things, you know, all the Enlightenment postman-esque things and Rushkoff and Hobbesian help them. But deep down and here secretly on Team Human, I can ask the real soul-searching questions that I'm having about whether this works. I mean, I watched Don't Look Up, and I know that's just a movie, and it's just a story, but it seems like an accurate depiction of how we respond collectively to crisis, whether slow or fast moving.
Totally with you on the sort of complicated way in which in public we are compelled to uphold our rationalist Enlightenment beliefs about democracy, while we may in private secretly wonder about the what seems to be a kind of unstoppable force of emotional response, and then that whole loyalty sort of are the parts of ourselves that actually feel like our group identities force us to make certain politically correct or other choices on behalf of our team, whatever team that is.
Yep.
But I think either or thinking, the binary thinking is a little bit of a trap, Doug. So it's not that rationality has gone away and been replaced by, you know, this kind of crazy emotional snap judgment kind of thing. And it's not the case that rationality has been replaced by team loyalties. It's like all of those things are in play all the time.
Right.
Right. And so we have to be able to, in a way, I think the last, you know, 20 years has helped us understand that we're discovering how to live in a culture without gatekeepers. And it might take us another 100 years. I mean, if communication history has anything to say about it, things may get worse before they get better because we got to figure it out.
Right.
But we're trying. I feel like it's okay that you have dark days. We're trying to figure it out.
So you'd go almost, I mean, there's so many ways to frame it, but you could say we're going from a kind of a command and control media space to this more cybernetic systems one. We're going from one where we are governed by governors to one that we're going to be somehow, ideally, a self-regulating society, that there's going to be some other way that we neutralize our most toxic elements and forge collaborative structures.
Yeah. And think about McLuhan's insights on this, right? You know, at the beginning of the shift toward an audiovisual culture, right? Moving away from print, he said, look, it's becoming all about storytelling and emotions. It's becoming all about the power of the image and the gaze, and it's becoming increasingly tribal.
Mm.
Wow. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so now the tribalism is on steroids, right? As we find our online communities that reinforce for us the messages we want to hear. And that's not just happening in the Red Party. That's happening like crazy in the Blue Party too, right?
Right.
And so I feel like in some senses that learning to think with all the parts of our brain. I'm reading Jonathan Haidt's, what's it called? The Righteous Mind.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God, you should have him on Team Human, The Righteous Mind. He's a psychologist. He's a moral psychologist who looks at how our ideas about moral values, how they include different elements. And I'm starting to realize that I've been all about care and harm and fairness and injustice. Mm. This is the classic liberal paradigm for thinking about morality, right? Care and harm and fairness and injustice. But there are other moral systems that are at work in humanity, like loyalty, like authority and sanctity. Mm. And so I've been thinking a lot about how the internet creates places for us to have conversations about what's good and what's bad, what's moral and immoral, what has value and what is junk. And I probably need to get practice at looking across all five of those moral systems, not just the two that I've been trained for,
right?
At the University of Michigan, at Harvard,
right? Yeah,
and through my religious beliefs.
Interesting. I mean, I guess I've got a parallel need to open to other experiences as well. I mean, for me, you know, I was raised as a literate Jew, right? And a literate Jew believes, you know, we have a text-only religion. We have a ban on images, right? You're not even allowed to put graven images in the thing. No pictures. It's a text-only, like an ASCII 2 religion, right? The text-only religion. And I was always, and I wrote this book on Judaism, Nothing Sacred, that was really arguing for the, you know, the Jewish intellectual path and trying to really, I almost called it Judaism after tribalism, to say, let's get rid of all that tribal stuff because that's where all the kind of hate and both you hate others and feel special and ethnocentrism, but maybe there are visual and tribal elements of human nature that aren't just dangerous. They don't just lead to Nazis and stuff or localism of an awful sort, right? That maybe having some sense of tribe is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah, for sure. It turns out that having feelings of tribal identity is deeply, from a DNA point of view, has been really important for our survival, right? And especially during times of sudden change or crisis. And so in some ways, after the 2016 election, a lot of feelings of crisis have been bubbling up, right? And when people feel in crisis, they go back to their tribe and they take direction from their tribe. And that's been very functional for human survival. And at the same time, another thing that happens during crisis is we look to our leaders to guide us. And so that seems to be happening more, right? And that can be very unsettling to those of us who are rooted in the Enlightenment tradition of the rational mind, because loyalty and authority are operating not in the realm of rationality.
Right. But they do appeal to something. You know, I was watching The Crown, you know, and they're teaching baby Queen Elizabeth about government. And there's this guy who's reading, I forgot the book on the monarchy to her, and explaining that, well, we've got parliament for the practical purpose of government, and we've got the monarchy for the dignity of government. And I'm like, dignity, that's an interesting.
Yeah.
Human beings want dignity.
Yeah.
And I understand then that Trump was trying to, in his way, to appeal to both, to say, oh yeah, I'm a businessman, I can do this, but I'm going to bring back, you know, a certain level of, I'll be the daddy authoritarian, magical president.
Yeah. And our friend Walter Lippmann, way back in 1921, said that people rely on thought leaders to shape their thinking, that it's a myth to think that we're creating independent critical thinkers who can think with autonomy, right? That's just ridiculous, right? We're part of a web, an interconnected web of people, and we influence each other, and we rely on thought leaders. The listeners of Team Human rely on you, Doug Rushkoff, as a thought leader.
I like to think of it that this is an egalitarian thing, and I'm just resonating with I'm not leading their thought. I'm resonating with their intelligence, helping articulate what they're all feeling no better. I'm not some TED Talk person, you know, with better ideas for other people's future. You know, I'm one of us is the whole point of Team Human.
Okay.
But at the same time, I get so many people emailing saying, Doug, you've got to accept that you are leading. What you've got to accept that even if it's a social construction.
Understandable with your identity position that stance, the stance of thought leader is complicated, but you have owned that position since you were a baby. Right? Since you were a very, very young man, a wunderkind, right? So
well, that's
of course
just
it feels
the person,
natural to you.
Right. That person who's sitting with his friends and says, hey guys, let's do this. That's thought leadership, right?
And now thought leaders are not just those who produce PBS documentaries, are not just those who produce multiple books, they are not just people with advanced degrees or expertise. Now thought leaders are those social media influencers, those
right.
people who are telling you about the keto diet, those crazy people who are telling you that the election was stolen, right? So now thought leaders are coming from everywhere. They're bubbling up. And the criteria to be a thought leader seems to rely less on any expertise or any special knowledge that you have than your ability to be charismatic. And that takes us all the way back to the Greeks, doesn't it? And
right.
They told us that ethos, you know, the credibility or the character of the speaker could shape and influence the public mind.
So it means we can no longer, or someone like me, if I've been doing it, can no longer ignore the importance of charisma and narrative and storytelling and packaging and rhetoric to the success of important ideas.
Right. And of course, you've always been a good storyteller, right? And used stories as a way to shape big, complicated, abstract ideas. I feel like one of the things that I've been thinking a lot more about by studying propaganda is the way in which anger can be activated. So there's emotions and then there's emotions, right? And certain emotions, you know, the whole turning up the metrics of engagement, as the platform companies found that if they could make people angry, they could get
right.
keep people on their devices longer. It's like that that is having a corrosive effect on the quality
yeah.
of public discourse. And I think media literacy helps people by making them at least aware
yeah.
of that. And that's a step.
Yeah. It's become a three-body problem in a way. It's like instead of you know, people who want to help people think and people who want to stop people from thinking, being in this battle, which they've been in for a long time, now the platform itself, the environment, has an agenda. you know what I mean? I felt like scrolls didn't have an agenda as scrolls. They just kind of sat there, read me or not, you know, unfurl me. But
wait a sec. I got to call you on that. That's totally wrong.
Yeah.
Scrolls did have an agenda. Scrolls wanted you to think in a linear way. You couldn't start at
right.
the end. Scrolls had an agenda around promoting a first this, then
right.
that. And that was an agenda. And
right.
the internet has an all-at-once agenda. Click, 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 click. Right?
Right.
And use your feeling to move through this web of multiple authors with multiple agendas, sometimes without even being aware of who these people are and what their agendas really are. And that's the dangerous part.
Yeah. Although weirdly, you know, I mean, I remember when Trump first won – when he won his first term as president. that's so mean to do. When Trump won, I remember Dana Boyd, our friend, came out with this article on somewhere, and you know, a Medium or something, arguing that this was the problem of not too little media literacy, but kind of too much, that we had opened a can of worms kind of and given people who weren't ready for it this deconstructive ability, and now they're deconstructing everything. And it really wasn't until the last few weeks when what urged me to call you that I looked at it and thought, God, could she be right about this? Because, I mean, when I saw it immediately, I think I texted you right away and was like, oh my God, what's happening? No. But there is a certain sense to it that a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Well, I think what Dana was suggesting is that asking critical questions about what you watch, see, and read can be dangerous, not just to right. you, but to the institutional power structures that are necessary for democratic cultures to flourish. And she's right about that, of course. Asking critical questions is dangerous.
Right. That's why they get rid of critical thinkers sometimes. Yeah.
And I feel like in some ways after the 2016 election, and certainly Dana's experience of like looking at the dark side, her, you know, the underbelly, the sort of unanticipated consequences of web culture, right? It made her like a canary in the coal mine, very sensitive to that. But asking critical questions has always been dangerous and always been destabilizing. And so she recognized that, yes, asking critical questions is at the heart of what conspiracy theorists do. Mm-hmm. It's what anti-vaxxers do, right? It's what climate change deniers do. And so she was right to notice that there's power. It's like this is a hammer, but it can be used for a variety of different purposes. It can be used for morally good purposes and morally questionable purposes. And I feel like let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here, right? Let's just recognize we're in an epistemological crisis where everyone has this hammer to ask critical questions. And there are some moral consequences to what we choose to hammer and why.
Right. And how we do it. Because there's certainly a great argument to be made for let's explore Western civilization's reliance on vaccination. And what are the long-term consequences of trying to come up with a vaccination for everything? What are the long-term consequences on our immune system as people? You know, is it equivalent of giving people lots of Prozac, you know, in a world that's hard to a world that is putting too much anxiety and pressure on us, you know, and you could say, wait a minute, why am I taking this drug? This is, you know, this is forcing conformity. And you could say, look, we're throwing antibiotics at every bacteria. It's a losing battle. They're mutating faster than we could stop them. And you're just going to grow super fat. I could see that, but there's a discipline that goes along with critical thinking that we don't seem to have.
Great word choice there, Doug. There's a discipline. You know, when I'm having a sniffle or my ear is hurting or, I don't know, something feels achy, I go to Dr. Google. And within a second or so, I get really scared because now I've turned my small little ache and pain into something terribly horrible and dangerous and scary. And why? Why did that happen? Because I was getting information without the disciplinary training and context to really understand it. And I have to go to my doctor who laughs at me and says, Renee, words I don't understand. You're an idiot. And I feel like in some ways that's another reason why I'm such a big promoter. I feel so committed to want to pair intellectual curiosity with intellectual humility, right? That the only solution to that, now that people can get access to information without the disciplinary training and expertise that's needed to contextualize it and understand it properly, then we have to be more sensitive to is how to be humble about the limits of our knowledge, right? And not get rigid in our thinking, not to basically prioritize my interpretation over any of a number of other interpretations that might provide more context. And then maybe even to trust thought leaders who have disciplinary expertise. So maybe in the next 100 years, we'll be reinscribing authority so that we can appropriately follow the thought leaders that help us make the best interpretation of the limits of knowledge.
And recognizing the different kinds of expertise. I feel like there's a snobbishness in that, oh, you know, doctor expertise and engineer expertise and, you know, professor expertise. But, you know, I had a guy came and fixed my air conditioner. And there was one process where we had to stand there for 2 hours waiting for something to fill. And I asked him questions and he proceeded to nerd out in front of me. You know, this is a Ford 150 driving, Trump supporting air conditioner guy nerded out so deeply on how pressures in HVAC systems work and why most of these guys don't understand what they're doing and they ruin systems and have to replace them and all. And I was like, this guy is a friggin' genius of this. This is, and to trust another person, it felt the same as going to a doctor and having them really understand what's wrong and give you the right thing. This guy really understood. He saved me thousands of dollars. He saved my system by using his expertise. And it's beautiful, but we don't, I feel like I'm living in a society that doesn't recognize that the so-called blue-collar worker, whatever they are, people are somehow, you know, bringing something not as important to the logical equation, to the sum of human knowledge, you know, which is what the Team Human thing is for. It's like, oh my God, everybody's got such deep knowledge. If only we respected their domain.
And this is why every child ages 5 to 25 wants to be a YouTuber when they grow up. Because if we're talking about, you know, Wikipedia being a democratic place, a place where all knowledge can be accounted for, YouTube is the place where all kinds of expertise, all kinds of specialized knowledge can flourish. And I feel like in some ways, you know, that harkens back to what Eddie Bernays said about propaganda being essential to the democratic process. You know, he said, oh, if instead of just big companies who can afford to spend a lot of money on advertising, right, and push and repeat messages to you over and over and over, if everyone can use the power of, he called it public relations, right, to express their ideas about what should happen and how it should happen, then he said labor unions would be able to deliver their messages about the important function they serve in society, and women would be able to have more political power, and minorities' voices would actually be heard through propaganda, through public relations. And at the time, well, you know, his critics pilloried him for it. But it turned out
people like us, But, you know, and people always talk about that Virginia Slims or whatever commercial or thing he did, you know, where he had the New York debutantes walk down during the Macy's Day Parade smoking cigarettes as their torches of freedom. And we always like to criticize him. It's like, oh, look, he got women to smoke. It's like, yeah, maybe, but he leveraged the power of a cigarette brand to launch a women's movement. You know, I mean, these were progressive values, perhaps slightly cynically advanced, but there's more than one thing going on.
For sure, for sure. And I would say he tapped into the existing shifts going on in the culture for female empowerment. Those things were happening, and he linked his product to that existing set of values. And so in some ways, what's complicated is we're now seeing that same practice happening in a bunch of different directions. You know, the Stop the Steal people, crazy as they are linking their movement, right, to a set of values. And in a way, I think the battleground we liberals can be sometimes afeared of, right, is the epistemological crisis is linked to a set of values and ideologies, right, about whose vote counts, whose voices matter. And so I feel like the sooner we're able to sort of step into that space of getting more comfortable talking about values and ideology, the better. What's been problematic in my community, of course, is that the conservatives have basically created the crisis associated with an idea, that of critical race theory, and they have pushed, mobilized people into attacking educators and librarians and people in public schools, right, for even exploring issues of race and racism. Now, that is a hot mess for media literacy. Yeah. Once certain ideas have been associated with values that can't be brought into schools, yikes, Houston, we have a problem.
Right. And then it becomes hard. So then we have certain school districts that are saying that, you know, Nazism has to be taught in a balanced way. And they could say, well, if you want to teach slavery in America in a balanced way, then we get to teach Nazism in a balanced way.
Yeah. Oy. Hey, maybe it's just time to return to the fairness doctrine. What do you think about that? Is that a crazy idea or what?
Yeah,
back in the old days. Right? Back in the old days, there was this idea that if you were going to use the powerful megaphone of the mass media, that you had an obligation to be fair. And in some ways, when that went away, hyperpartisanship ruled, right? And Rush Limbaugh was born, and the madness of Fox News.
But then you could argue that, I mean, the fairness doctrine went away partly because, right, Reagan and because they got rid of it, but it also got put away because the news function of broadcast media changed.
Right.
You know, they used to have be obligated, if they had an FCC license, to do a certain amount of public activity for which the news counted. It was not a profitable thing. It was an obligation. When the fairness doctrine was gone and the FCC obligation to do news went away, then the only reason news stayed was as for-profit entertainment. And then, as I think as Adorno would correctly tell us, if your news is for-profit entertainment under capitalism, you will only get fascism at the end.
Yeah, and here we are.
Right. Because the purpose of the news is to sell things, not to inform us.
Yep. So in some ways, that's what brings us to our epistemological crisis around maybe we can't work our way out of this mix. Maybe under the new reality of surveillance capitalism, since our every keystroke is being monetized, and if they know more about us than we know about ourselves, then we're always going to be vulnerable. We're always going to be manipulated in one way or the other. Even in the face of all that, though, Doug, you know, I guess I just was born with the optimism gene. You know, I'm not afraid of the future. I recognize that things may get worse before they get better, and that really we have to think about this in relation to the long game. But, you know, what the Enlightenment helped us to really understand was that the power of both the individual human mind and team human, right? And I do feel like we're going to get into balance, a better understanding about our loyalties and the way in which we construct authority, and maybe even the way in which we think about sanctity, right? Like, for instance, wouldn't it be great if over the next 5 years we mobilized propaganda to get people to feel a spirit of sanctity toward the climate and the greenhouse gases and the carbon being dumped into the atmosphere? What if we could feel a sense of sanctity about the need to protect this planet? Because I am sick of these wildfires. I am sick of these storms. Yeah. I understand that human-caused climate change is destroying the planet, and a feeling of sanctity toward protecting the planet could mobilize people in ways that rational argument doesn't.
Well, that, and there goes to my sort of ethical media question, is the construction that I have always bridled against is the construction of, if we could only get people to blank, that once we're getting people to do something, it's as if I know what they need, and now I'm going to get them to do it, kind of by any means necessary. Ends justifies the means, as long as I get people to believe what I know to be correct. And you know what I mean? And it's like, I did Brecht theater, not regular theater, because at least people could be distant and objective and know they're watching a play. And I'm always scared to use my magical powers of influence to get people to do things with storytelling and stuff.
Yeah, I've noticed that about you. That's a very interesting observation. That's because you want people to think for yourself because you have strong feelings about autonomy, like you said.
Yeah.
The autonomy of your listeners, the autonomy of your readers. But you know, the Greeks suggested to us way back when the very first democracies were founded that all human language was fundamentally persuasive, that every time mm-hmm. a word comes out of your mouth, there is a persuasive function to it. Now, you can admit it or you can deny it, Doug.
They're right. We inflect. I inflect my language. I'm inflecting. Why am I inflecting? You know, and you could go and then use neurolinguistic programming to say, oh, look at your inflection. You inflect it up here because it manipulates the neocortex cerebellum of the brain here. And then you moved your left arm, which is, you know, going to their quadrant of persuasion. You know what I mean? They would deconstruct because they can use it. I mean, when you try to do it, you sound like Al Gore. Right? It never works, right? Hello, I am using neurolinguistic. You know, it sounds fake, but... But right, everything I've evolved to persuade. I am a walking propagandist. You know, how could you not be? Whether my button is done or not is propaganda.
Right. And that's because you're part of Team Human. We are not individual monkeys. We are part of a community. And the hive mind, the ability for one bee to influence another, is actually what makes the hive successful.
Right. Exactly. Listen to me. Warning. Right. You have to be able to alert the other cells around you and say there's something, and you're all shouting and listening and, right.
And how beautiful that the bees who are listening to Team Human are themselves then propagating other ideas. And that's how ideas move through a culture. So
right.
I don't think we need to be afraid
of that. And feeding back.
Exactly. Right. We don't need to be afraid of that. And ultimately, in the long view, we can feel really optimistic about that. Because some part of that is the respect for the fact that each of us filters ideas and information through our own experiences, unique experiences. That raises questions that are unique to us as individual. That's the fertility of imagination and knowledge that I feel like... let's hold on to our respect for that fertility of knowledge to get us through what seems like a complicated, dark time filled with disinformation and propaganda.
Yeah. And the other illusion of this internet era is that there are more influencers rather than fewer. I feel like there's real power law dynamics at play here, and that people are less reliant on local experts and people in their world, the elders in their own community. And they are turning to the Twitch girl with 90 million followers, you know, rather than, and in some ways that leads to a paucity of leadership, not an explosion of it.
A fragmentation of leadership.
Right.
Not a paucity, right? There's a lot of leaders, but they're becoming like micro tribes, micro communities.
I'm hoping that I would rather them be micro communities than a billion people following, you know, eight, you know, Paris Hiltons.
Good point. Yeah, so that power law, that's a really interesting question about eventually will the micro celebrities cluster into a power law? Well, there will really be eight of them. Based on my experience with my undergraduate students, I would say we're way far away from that because, man, good. Do they follow. And in fact, I think we have the opposite problem, really, which is it's so tribalized. The female students don't have nothing to do with the kinds of media messages that the male students have. The African-American students are consuming media that has nothing to do with the way that white students are. There's like, I think... a lot of sort of fragmentation of discourse, which makes us old people long back for the common culture function that media serves.
Yeah.
And maybe Netflix is that new common culture.
It could be, although Netflix sends you out in your little algorithm
true.
Too. I mean, I'm feeling the common culture is the local culture that seems, especially now under COVID, is you know, really languishing. But at least when I live in a town, I walk down the streets, I know old people, young people, black people, white people, storekeeps and doctors. And there's something so beneficial to having this wide assortment of demographics, you know, because we happen to live together.
It goes back to your HVAC guy, doesn't it? Maybe the future has in it a celebration of geographic community, which works great for you people within a 100-mile radius of New York City and is probably less great for people who are in the buckle of the Bible Belt or somewhere else, right?
Well, at least I got farms for food, you know? They'll survive a lot easier, you know?
Yeah, so the new localism, I don't know. We've been hearing about that for like a long time, though, and I'm not so optimistic about that.
No, I don't really see it so much. I mean, I always want, you know, yes, support your CSA and, you know, you buy local food and you'll be healthier and see where your water comes from and get involved in your public schools. And, you know, there, and for all of that, there's the equal and opposite, you know, let's privatize schools and do vouchers and go online and
I'm
leave
actually
all these
betting,
people behind.
I'm going to go back to my original theme here. I'm actually betting for the future what I'm betting on, and I'm really talking about my own self too, is I have been preoccupied with care and harm and fairness and justice. And I have not paid enough attention to the role of authority and loyalty and sanctity in my life and in my relationships and in my professional identity as an educator and an activist. And so I feel like I want to try to widen my moral lenses, like the glasses that I put on, because I'm getting bored and tired with this fairness and justice and care and harm. I mean, enough said about the limitations of only perceiving the world through those limited lenses. And it's clearly not reaching lots of people who find those perspectives to be incomplete.
Well, it's interesting though, as someone who intentionally retrieved and brought sanctity into my discussion since around 1999, these are dangerous waters. You talk about sanctity in an academic place, they think you're crazy. They really, it's, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, you're now Bible thumping or you got faith or something. It's like, I'm talking about the sanctity of life. It's like, because there's a scientistic wave, you know, that in the humanities, even since the 70s or 80s, where I see so many of my media studies people leaving the humanities to turn it into some kind of a social science. And it's like, yeah, they're sociologists. You could do your quantitative analysis and go do all that stuff and find numbers and graphs and K-squared, you know, charts and stuff. But this is Neil Postman would agree, this is a sacred task. The only weapon in the end, he said, against the technopoly was religion, right?
Wow. So this is actually fascinating to me, Doug. I'm starting to wonder, have the care, harm, fairness, social justice lenses that are dominant in our cultures, have they become oppressive as they negate the validity of these other moral lenses? Because it might be that part of the movement, the tension, the red and blue tension in our country is due to the fact that in some parts of Democratic America, those are the only lenses to be used, and you get ridiculed or humiliated if you apply other moral lenses. And that's a form of oppression, right? And I felt the oppressiveness. Yeah. I mean, I sometimes try to be politically incorrect just to watch people have a little shush about it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's so ridiculous.
But you're right that there's a the structural analysis and bias of some of the social justice analysis negates human intention. right? What you meant, what you mean, what you intend doesn't matter. And I don't think that's an appropriate reading of Marx. Marx was so much finally about, when he was arguing that economics was social, he meant social. I mean, that I'm making a burrito for you, you know? There was love. There's love in literature. If you read him, I see Marx as a humanities writer, not an economics writer.
And in some ways, Marx was trying to heighten tribal awareness.
Yeah.
So that workers could use their power, their collective power, mm-hmm. against a capital. And so this idea that new forms of tribal identities are actually what we kind of need to respect. We don't need to be afraid of that, right? We need to honor that and respect that. I feel like in some ways the internet can make it possible. I mean, we were so excited about the Arab Spring. Remember that back then?
Yeah.
When we thought
we thought
that this would be enough, and it was like not enough.
Right. Well, there was no theory of change.
Well, I think the idea of the power, the only one moral lever was at work there, which is this, sort of shared group identity, right? Mm. And Occupy helped us realize that, you know, there were lots of different identities and positions within this shared group, and there could be strength in that. We overlook our differences to look at our similarities, right? And I do feel like I hope that in my lifetime, I'm angry that my children and grandchildren are living in a culture where red and blue are like good and bad and true and false. And I think that's wrong. I think that's really wrong, because I do believe in the Enlightenment Project. You need to encounter false messages and untruths to know what the truth is, right? And I do trust people to make decisions that are in their best interest. I do recognize that we're all imperfect as we make the world. But we got to get beyond this, real erosive polarization. And I think the only way to do it is through communication and education.
Right. Two industries, but yeah, we can call them two industries that are in peril.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for different reasons. You know, one, communications is too profitable, and education is not profitable enough.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. That's interesting.
There
are real implications to that framing, by the way. Because in a way, what's so fascinating is that there's pressures on either both ways, right? The whole do-it-yourself YouTube culture is pushing against Hollywood and mm-hmm. big communication, and the Ivy Leagues are pushing on the issue of education and profitability.
I'm worried for the Ivy Leagues, even. You know, my daughter. Well, my daughter is finally applying to college now, and I got into Princeton. Back in whenever that was, 1979, I would not get into Princeton today. The kids who get into these schools now are do-gooders. They are. I mean, not all of them. I don't want to be mean to anybody, but there's a conformity. There's a to kids who are agreeing, I'm going to get all A's, I'm going to do what my teachers want, I'm going to get high on these tests. And there seems to be less room in these institutions of higher learning for the weirder independent thinkers.
Wow. Interesting point. And I would agree up to a point. I think there's two things possibly going on. I do think that, yes, education is rewarding conformity, and kids arrive in, sixth grade saying, what hoops do I have to jump through? I'm going to jump through the hoop so I can get to Harvard, right? But when they're not in school, they're out like on Twitch watching streamers and they're making their little influencer videos and they're watching TikTok and making dance videos, right? So there's flourishing of sort of remix creativity happening among these very high achievers when they're not in school. It's just that they don't, it's just that school rewards this only right. this one track. So how could we modify that so school could celebrate the whole human being, right? Not just the high achiever who tests well.
Right. And it's hard because it's gotten so automated. Everybody can do a standard application. They can apply to 3,000 schools at once. And these poor admissions people, I don't know if they're poor, but they, you know, they've got to, if you've got to read 100 applications in an evening, you're going to use the numbers. And, you know, the kids that did all the high achieving, you know, that's just the bar to then be considered. And then you'll see if they can write essays about their Twitch videos.
Which brings us back to storytelling, right? So what compels human attention and interest has always been storytelling, right? So when your daughter writes that kick-ass college essay, it's going to be a story.
Right.
She's going to write a story, and that story is going to grab people by the throat and say, wow, what an original human being she is.
Although, interestingly, the college counselors, they all say now, well, you got to think about how your essays work together to form a complete picture of who you are. So they're not just writing essays, they are crafting an identity.
Oh, yeah, but teenagers are good at that. They've been crafting an identity since they were born.
They've been self-fashioning one way or another, right, since they picked up their first iPad.
They're well prepared for the task.
Oh, my gosh. All right, well, I feel a little bit better.
Are you over your crisis?
I'm not over it. This is going to be the rest of my life. But I think partly because I was raised as a Jew whose relatives were murdered by Cossacks. I've borne more fear of propaganda and story and rumor than might have been necessary, right? I was raised, you know, by parents and grandparents who told me, you know, your great-grandfather was hanged because people believed, you know, Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And, you know, and we've got to, you know, educate people and be very nonfiction-y so that people don't get swept up again in a crazy story and come for you. And I think that that's a bit harsh, you know.
There's a lot of ways to change hearts and minds.
Right.
And it's an interesting thing about how that position gives the communicator a lot of power, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, you've always had respect for the powerful function of communication because that's part of that story, right? Be afraid of these powerful communicators who can shift reality. And
right.
I actually think I'm really over that now. You know, this whole disinformation, misinformation stuff. Yeah, I get it. But I don't just make me afraid, right? I got to get beyond fear to actually take action.
Yeah, I know. And that's why it's funny now. I mean, and I'm fine for students to see the social dilemma and all that and learn about the evils of social media. But the underlying premise is that this stuff necessarily works, that Facebook is that good, that human beings are being programmed by whatever they look at, wherever they set their eyes. No, they're not. No, they're not. They still have autonomy. This Mark Zuckerberg's not that good. Cambridge Analytica is not that good. These are just business people. And if the extent to which you blame Cambridge Analytica and Facebook for what happened to America is the extent to which you are buying their sales propaganda of the effectiveness of these bullshit primitive tools.
Yeah, that is such an important point to make. And of course, it all goes back to Baum and the Wizard of Oz, right? It turns out that the great and powerful Oz is just a guy, right, behind a curtain. And really the job of unmasking that power and recognizing its form, its characteristics, its structures, this is very liberating, right? And it can happen for kids starting in 3 and 4 and 5 years old. It's not magic.
to gain that sense of autonomy and the ability to make sense of the powerful forms of communication around us. It's not magic, but
parents or that is magic. That's, you know what I mean?
It's its own form of magic.
Right. That's what magic is, right? Or certainly closer. That's closer to magic than anything else. Yeah. You know what I mean? Seeing behind the curtain, that's your initiation to the magical world. Oh, that's yes. what it was.
Well, and yeah. even more importantly, you're illustrating through your show how it happens. It happens through dialogue. Mm. It happens through discussion. So it's not an app. It's not a curriculum. It's not a video. It's not a program. It's a process of dialogue. It's the give and take and exchange of ideas.
Yeah.
That's what ignites the human mind. And that's what creates Team Human.
Right. And if nothing else, the example of, oh, Doug's got a problem. He's soul searching. He's upset. What does he do? He turns to Renee. Here's my problem. Here's my soul. Here's my crisis. How do we work this? And Renee thinks about it and comes back. Oh, I see. Well, I'm working on it like this. Oh, okay. I mean, you know what I mean? This is what we're here for. This is why there's more than one person.
Yeah. And thank God. And thank yeah. God we can get by with a little help from our friends, right? That's yeah. how I'm going to get through the semester is I'm going to be able to count on my Media Education Lab friends and my dialogues and ways to talk about my problems with teaching. Because, you know, as I struggle with how to teach this generation, right? I run into all kinds of paradoxes and contradictions. Mm. And I've learned so much to actually just share that, right? And get advice and get ideas, get another way of thinking. Because my friends yep. can often decenter me out of my own limitations and solve my own problems.
And you know what? And I want to tell people, you know, I think that your masterwork is your latest book.
Yeah, it's called Mind Over Media, Propaganda Education in a Digital Age.
Right. Mind Over Media, Propaganda Education in a Digital Age. The thing that's so great about it as a even a layperson's book on propaganda is that engaging with how do you teach propaganda is the greatest window to understanding propaganda. You know what I mean? You go meta on propaganda becomes our way in. So it's not a book about propaganda. It's a book about how do we wrestle with living inside a propaganda sphere? How do you make people aware of the atmosphere, the environment of propaganda? How do you denaturalize it, you know, in a way so that you can recognize it? And that, to me, is why, and not just as a media educator, that's why I read it and I go, ah, this is the way. This is the way to teach propaganda to people, is to have them think about how would they teach propaganda, you know?
Well, we both have always had a predilection for the meta, haven't we?
Yeah, that's true. But now everybody seems to. It's the new thing. We were there first.
Hey, that'd be a nice topic for a future episode. Help me understand the mainstreaming of meta, will ya?
I will. It started with Beavis and Butthead, but which I got teased for analyzing in serious tones back then. But remember, back then you couldn't. TV wasn't considered literature.
Oh well. Yeah, I wrote a 50-page paper on Saturday Night Fever, so I definitely got that.
Yeah, there you go.
Went back when it was not cool, and now it's cool, right? So, but
yeah.
In some ways, that brings new problems, doesn't it? That brings new problems to our
yeah,
field and
sure.
to our discipline that we could explore in the future as we think about, you know, what is media studies in the 21st century, and how does media study as a field continue to be relevant to the changing needs that students have? And how does it get away from being vocational preparation for the next set of influencers and sponsored content sellers?
I know, which is what most schools would love media studies departments to be. How do we sell ourselves as that while doing something else? Well, I love you lots, Renee Hobbs.
Thanks for having me on Team Human. This was a fun conversation, Doug.
And thank you for being on Team Human. Our guest today was the author of Mind Over Media and the founder of the Media Education Lab at University of Rhode Island, Renee Hobbs. You can find out more about Renee and her work at teamhuman.fm, where you can find out about all of our guests and become a supporting member of the team. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and engineered by Luke Robert Mason. A special shout out and thanks to our founding producer and engineer, Stephen Bartolome, and to all of you for your support of our collective and continuing intervention in the machine. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. Taking us out today, a new track by the band Eclipsing Binary, who are members of Team Human and sent us this song, The Soul in the Machine. Thanks again for sending that one to us. The special thing I can think of that we regular biological humans have that the robots don't is soul. Moral sensibility is all the stuff that the arch atheists will say don't exist. That's all we got. The possibility that we live in a moral universe, that we have a conscience, a sensibility, that we come from a place of meaning. And you could say it's not a real thing. Like some superstitious projection. But that may be all we have. At the how. They're better than we are in all those ways. They're gonna be smarter, they're gonna be faster, they're gonna be more productive, but they don't have the why. Or to the right and the wrong. As projected as the soul of my little Grogu doll, well, on a certain level, I don't really care. I am fine for the majority or even all of my meaningfulness here in this universe to be a projection of other people projecting that into me. And I promise I will keep projecting that meaning onto you. If we've got nothing else, we've got each other. If we've got nothing else, we've got each other. We'll be right back.
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.